Today is Thursday. It's January 12th, 2017. This is John Williams, and you're listening to Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast, portions of which are broadcast on my Saturday afternoon show at 1:30 on WGN Radio.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of The Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
I'm Scott Standis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Eric Zorn, the distinguished columnist. Runs Wednesdays,
don't laugh,
Fridays.
Scott.
He's laughing at my branding efforts.
I'm sorry.
You know, I listened to Rex Hupke and Amy Guth's podcast the other day. They swear through the whole thing. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's so blue.
Yeah. Well, it's immature is what it is. You give somebody a podcast, tell them they can cuss, and what do? They cuss.
We don't need to do
it's
that.
It's good. I like the podcast. I even like the swearing. So.
My nose is out of joint today, guys, because Donald Trump, the president-elect, is picking on a singular industry in the United States and wishing it ill. And I'm not talking about the automotive industry. I'm talking about the press. This is just a typical tweet from him. It came this week after his press conference. At CNN is in total meltdown with their fake news because their ratings are tanking since election and their credibility will soon be gone. In fact, CNN's ratings are going up, and have been in this election cycle. I could quote you some numbers. For 2016, CNN saw its primetime ratings grow by 76% over 2015, and its total day viewership has increased 54% in the last year. And it's not just CNN he's picking on. He's picked on one particular industry, and he wishes it ill, and he's asking his millions of followers to hurt that sector of the American economy. And I just get so pissed off at that every time I see it. Every time I see it. So that's what I wanted to start with today.
Okay, but the result of his action is actually helping that.
I know. Well, he's not smart enough to realize that. But I know it's if you ban it in Boston, it will do well.
He's picking on BuzzFeed. Is BuzzFeed actually failing? I thought they were doing okay.
Well, I bet they're doing better now than they were last week.
Why are we talking facts when we're talking Donald Trump?
Right. Yeah, he said that about the New York Times.
Very quaint of you, John, to be talking about
that's adorable.
Factual figures. But
okay, so let's talk
about
that.
He's so pre-factual America.
See, well, I want to talk about that moment in the news conference. I think we all see it or have seen it. Where he is it John Acosta from what's his
I think it's
name?
Jim
Acosta, right, of course. He wants to ask a question because Trump has been picking on CNN, and he says, because you're picking on me, I'd like to ask a question. And Trump shouts him down. They get into a little exchange.
Don't be rude, he says.
And he says you're failing. You print fake news.
You're fake news.
You're a garbage. What does he say, a trash organization? What does he say? I mean, he won't. He won't. And my feeling was that at that point, that was the time in the room for all the journalists to band together to have their I am Acosta moment, and say you can't pick on him without picking on all of us because we represent collectively the media, which is the eyes and ears of the public. We're the ones who get to ask you questions because the public doesn't. And I really wish that the next person called on and said, I'd like to know what Mr. Acosta wanted to ask because I'm going to ask that question.
I do too, and I think that's the view of every journalist who wasn't in the room. I just think the dynamic might have been a little bit in the room.
The White House press corps is a singular, weirdly incestuous group that access is more important to them than camaraderie. I mean, I've experienced. I was there. I was actually in the press room when then Press Secretary Carney said that the attacks in Benghazi were caused by the video, and the New York Times reporter continued to press that no, it wasn't. And it was interesting that afterwards they were very angry. I was supposed to go to the press room, and they were very angry with our reporter for the Tribune Company, now Trong. And because she had not cleared a question, had not gone through certain channels with that Carney was asked, and it was like a softball question. But Carney was mad at the press corps, and the press corps was mad at her, which to my mind was I was flabbergasted. I was flummoxed. I could not understand why the press would have backed her instead of been mad at her and essentially ostracized her for that day.
Well, and another thing that happens in these news conferences is that Trump doesn't answer a question. He didn't answer the question about whether his campaign had been in touch with Russian officials during
that was
during
at the end
campaign.
Of the press conference. He said, "Will you once and for all clearly state that there was no communication?" And he diverted that.
Diverted that. He also didn't answer the question about what the plans were for Obamacare and for his repeal of Obamacare and whether the exemption for pre-existing conditions would remain. And the next journalist who got a question, instead of following up on that and listening to his answer, just went off and
that happens all the time.
He asked a 3-part question and ignored the fact that he didn't answer the last question because they're all about themselves. And I think this plays into what Scott's talking about, which is that they don't see themselves as part of an entity. They see themselves as part of as advancing their own careers and their own access.
Well, but
and power.
Okay. I don't go to many news conferences anymore, but when I did, there a lot of them, most of them, almost all of them are you sit there and reporters ask questions until they're out of questions and then you move on, right? So there's a luxury to blow your question on a follow-up to someone else's question that you wouldn't have at a White House news conference. Does that make sense?
You're only going to get one.
You're not going to get another one. And
that
if you went in
you
with one
with, yeah.
important, that's your only shot at doing it. That's kind of a little defense. I don't know if you guys buy that.
I think there's a bigger,
no, I buy that.
I think there's a bigger point here, and John made it when we first started this conversation, and that's the attack on the press. And Robert Reich, yes, I actually look at the other side regularly, and he does videos pretty regularly. He talks about the road to fascism and talks about what fascists do to the press, and they demonize them, they call them names, they try to, and it's worth a watch. It's on YouTube, you can look it up. But to John's point, that's terrifying to me now, is that the roadmap that we've seen before in the mid-20th century is being followed almost exactly.
Well, the president-elect did two things that, he did so many things that were remarkable, but yesterday he compared his intelligence briefers to Nazis, right? He said that's what they do in Nazi Germany, that when he was intimating that they were releasing it. And then he used an official Russian statement as defense for his action. Think of that. Has a U.S. president ever said, well, the Russians say it's true, so it must be so?
So to hell with my 17 different intelligence agencies and corporations. And by the way, Steve, I think his reference to Nazi Germany was really interesting, because I think a lot of us, however tempting that thing has been, try not to pick on that point because it's just too easy. And there is Donald Trump himself saying, this is what they did in Nazi Germany. And I thought, well, the true test of Nazi Germany is what you do about it, Mr. Trump. And if you try and manipulate or kill a free press, then we will have a Nazi-style regime here. So let's not even go down that road.
Can I throw something out real quick? Because I'm certainly of a certain age who grew up during the Cold War. And could you imagine if a president had been elected with the help of the Soviet Union? My God, he would have been impeached before he got sworn in.
We're missing the point here, though. So BuzzFeed posts
There are lots of points.
BuzzFeed posts a 38-page document, a dossier, and in it there are allegations that there was communication between the new administration and the Russians. That's one point. The other thing is this lurid sort of sexual detail. The president and president-elect are briefed on that, and CNN reports on the fact that they were briefed on that without actually posting these lurid details. CNN gets busted as a fake news site for it. My question to you guys is, was it really that important? Was it that necessary for CNN to tell that story? The New York Times didn't. I don't know that the Washington Post or Chicago Tribune did. But because BuzzFeed did, and because the White House was briefed on it, now CNN has a hook to hang
well,
on.
It's an absurd and
probably not true story.
I believe you have the state of events going a little bit backwards. I think what happened was CNN first reported the broad outlines, that there had been a briefing, that there had been this 2-page addendum that described in very vague terms that there was this what do they call it? There's a Russian term
dossier.
For it.
Where
they're trying to compromise. It's a Russian word for compromise. They were going to compromise Trump. And they
There's
had some,
no Russian word for compromise. Go ahead.
in the sense of blackmail compromise. And so I think BuzzFeed took that as their sense. Well, this story is now out there. I mean, and these kind of rumors have been going around for a long time, and no one has been able to get enough information on them to print them. BuzzFeed said, "Well, because they're talking about this now, we're going to show you what we have. We have this 35-page document, and it's very thinly sourced. Even too nice a word for it. I mean, people have. It doesn't appear to be true, right?
One British agent, former, who was working originally Trump's opponents during the primary, the Republicans, and then for the Democrats, they were asking this guy to find dirt on Donald Trump.
But then he didn't have buyers, but he apparently felt so strongly about it that he gave it, right, to McCain and gave it to others. So the guy wasn't just trying to create salaciousness to sell. When he didn't have a buyer, he believed in it enough to give it to McCain.
And it looks like the White House, it looks like the CIA or whoever presented it to the president felt strongly enough about it that they felt that the two of them should hear about this.
Well, I think the point you were getting at, or maybe not, is that I don't think CNN and BuzzFeed are in the same basket here.
I don't either.
I think what CNN did, the New York Times would have done, or the Washington Post or Chicago Tribune as well, right? I mean, if you guys had information that, if you had sources saying that the intelligence people gave Trump and Obama and the Gang of Eight access to this two-page dossier saying the Russians might have information on Trump, if you could confirm that, that's a big story.
Is it really? Because I think it's a big story because of the other stuff in there. We've been having that other conversation for a while.
Well, but the fact that they warned the president-elect and also the president in an official sort of exchange, I think that makes it newsworthy.
And of course, the Russians are denying it, but they would deny it if they had this information because it's like, you know, you've got an ace in your hand. No, well, I don't have an ace in my hand.
This isn't like a campaign where this will one day be released to hurt Trump to keep votes from him. They will keep this forever, keep it quiet if it exists, because then they will always have it over him.
Yeah, exactly.
The Russians, yeah. Well, but I mean, if it's true, I mean, really, Eric, you said it's thinly sourced. Where's the triple checking on something like this? Don't the CNNs of the world try and verify that the story's true before they go with it?
Exactly. The problem with Trump's indignation over this is that for 5 years he was promoting this grotesque lie about Obama's birth certificate, and he's the one who was pointing to the National Enquirer as his source for the rumors about Ted Cruz's father, and he was the one who will say things like, well, it's on the Internet, people are talking about it.
Or the birth certificate issue, or that he didn't graduate or didn't get in fairly into school.
He has no leg to stand on to complain about fake news.
And also, John, CNN's story is not what's in the memo. CNN's story is that intelligence presented the memo.
Presented. I know that.
So they don't have to triple source.
Absolutely.
You know,
because that's true. The fact that they presented it to the president, it could be a crossword puzzle. The president was presented with something, and that's what CNN was saying.
Right.
But I just don't think they can be surprised, given the salacious nature of it, that it would be met with some raised eyebrows. Do you think that would be such a hot potato if it wasn't for that other embarrassing stuff, this story? I don't know the answer to that. Maybe this Russian stuff is more compelling than I know. I haven't read the dossier, but it seems to me like CNN knew damn well this would be really embarrassing and ridiculous, and they went with it. I don't know what their intentions were.
I don't know what's ridiculous about it. I don't get that part. I mean, and
you believe the second half of that report? Do you think that stuff in the Ritz in Moscow really happened?
I hope not. I think that it fits with everything we've heard from.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it does.
No, he's a germaphobe.
It does.
He wouldn't do that.
Okay, but again.
What do you make of the excuse that BuzzFeed gave, which is that it's out there, people are talking about it, everyone in the media knows what it's about, so shouldn't the public know what it's about?
Let them decide.
There are Julian Assange now, right here in River City.
Well, wasn't it BuzzFeed that also had real-time streaming of exit polling during the election day?
No, it was Slate. But
there were three or four other sites.
But, you know, guys, this is the new world we live in. So the CNNs and the Chicago Tribunes of the world will hold themselves and each other to a certain standard. What's BuzzFeed? I think what do they care?
They want to play at that standard, I think, don't they?
Play at the high level or the low level?
They want to play at the high level.
They want to play at the click level. If they say, we've got this document, guess what? I don't think they care if it's been triple sourced or all that true. I mean, they're sure not acting like it if they do. And I don't think, by the way, millions of Americans care. I don't know that they're keeping score on who's super legitimate and not. They're just clicking and looking and reading and wagging their tongues.
Well, one of the things that we have always done in the dreaded mainstream media is we have been gatekeepers for rumors. And we, sitting around this table here, know of rumors about politicians, prominent politicians in Illinois history that have never seen the light of day because we just don't publish those set of rumors, and it's not justification to say, well, people are saying that. People are whispering that.
This is a podcast. Go ahead and give us one. It's the same.
Well, I mean, okay, I'll give you one, and that was that Harold Washington was gay. Right? I mean, people said that all the time. People said, oh, he's gray. He likes to dress in women's clothes. And remember the painting at the Art Institute?
The Art Institute.
And, you know, it was like, I don't think the Tribune ever wrote those words, those allegations.
Why not? Because true or not, it really wasn't that important either, right? His orientation isn't a news story.
Well, it might have been important to people, especially back in the
mid-80s. Back then, it was more important.
And it was just something like, people were talking about it. Because people were talking about it, we did not publish that. We didn't say, we're going to conduct an investigation, see if his Mary Ellen Smith or whatever her name was, his fiance, is just a beard. We're not going to, we just don't go there, you know? And even all these years later, it feels like I'm reluctant to say right. it even.
I've heard that before. I mean, and there's a list of them, I guess we could tick off. By the way, let's just segue quickly to Barack Obama's farewell speech. Donald Trump was defending himself and calling some of these outlets fake news sources when Barack Obama was saying farewell at McCormick Place. Steve, I know your son was there.
Eric,
I was following you while you were there. Guys, just give me kind of your reaction to that whole scene and what the president said.
I thought it was a great speech. I liked the way he sort of, it was an ending the way he began by fostering and encouraging individual action when it comes to democracy. That's the way he said goodbye. I don't think he spent too much time gloating. I mean, it wasn't a pure pat on the back. I don't think he brought up Syria, right? So, it was certainly a one-sided speech, but I liked the message of it, the fact. And also, I don't think you can say this enough, that ISIS can't destroy us. We can destroy ourselves over ISIS and things like that. When he said that, I love that. And then one other thing, when's the last time have you ever been to a speech where the politician says, and I've got just one more point, and the audience groans?
I noticed. I just love that.
I love that.
I was sad, too. And I said to Brenda said, boy, I went a lot longer. And I said, what do you mean that he spoke 20 minutes? She goes, he went an hour. I couldn't believe it. It didn't feel like that at all. It was very swift.
Well, I hate to rain on your parades here, guys. But, the farewell speech, which was a farewell address, which was a tradition begun, of course, by George Washington, and it was written down. And then I think it was Eisenhower was the first one to deliver one very somberly from the Oval Office on TV. And that was the tradition. Now, what I didn't care about this, and I'm going to readily admit this is an old fuddy-duddy, stay off my lawn moment, but that's how it should have been delivered, in my view, is the president talking directly to us, not a pep rally, and it was a good speech. And there are elements of it, per usual, that were terrific, absolutely terrific. But overall, I just thought it was an inappropriate way to deliver a farewell address.
What did Clinton do? Because my parents saw Clinton at the Palmer House. I know he did a series of little speeches. I don't know if he did one major one.
Yeah, he did, and it's appropriate. You wrap up what your accomplishments, you talk about what should happen next, and then you leave office. But this guy's not really even leaving Washington, D.C., for crying out loud.
Trump's is going to have his at a monster truck rally. So.
And it'll be huge.
Those moments. You have to not do that.
Eric, will it be April or May?
Yeah. I still, by the way, think he doesn't finish the first term, but I want to go back to Barack Obama's. Thank you.
Fingers crossed.
I want to go back to Barack Obama's speech. I said that Brenda and I were a little disappointed how quickly it was going or went. But actually, I don't think it was a great speech either. I'm with Scott on this. And it's not because of the venue. It felt to me like a pretty good State of the Union address. It wasn't soaring. I didn't feel like there were some giant takeaway messages or perfectly crafted Obama sentences. I kept waiting for that part of the speech where I would go, and I'd never.
Well, here's the thing about that. It was not a State of the Union tends to be like a laundry list of policy proposals.
There was some of that.
A little bit. His victory lap that he took was about two paragraphs long. It was a lot about preserving democracy. I think that Obama has over the years given so many speeches at that high level that you're so used to it. You're used to those. I mean, it was a pretty ordinary Obama speech, which is to say it was a really, really good speech, but it wasn't. It didn't go like, wow, that was particularly good for him. It was pretty ordinary for him. So you're grading him on a curve, and is it his best speech ever? No, is it his most compelling, gripping, transformative speech? No.
That's an interesting point, Eric. But I mean, I think to Scott's point, why the venue? Why this rock concert presentation? I do think it's justified in that he wasn't just speaking to America, or he wasn't speaking about the last 4 years. he really was taking the long view. He wanted us to look back at this speech 25 years from now and say that's when we were at a critical juncture in our democracy and Barack Obama said this.
Don't you think that was, don't you think he reiterated going out the message that he came in with?
He did, except that the message he came in with was naive. This is my problem with him. I mean, I love the guy. I mean, I think he was a very good president, and mm-hmm. his 2004 speech, very stirring. You know, we're all one people. But Trump's election sort of proved that all that talk about we all have so much in common. We all share these values. We can all pull on the same oars together. That just didn't prove to be that true. And
what's he supposed to say?
Well, I was hoping that he was going to set forward some sort of an agenda, some sort of a plan. Point out the perils that are ahead, and to talk about how to mobilize for those.
Yeah,
things.
I think he did. Actually, I think
that
he
would not have played well.
It wouldn't have played well, but he did do that. He tiptoed, I think, a very nuanced in words that we're not going to use for the next 4 years. A very nuanced, subtle way. He addressed these issues.
Goodbye, nuanced. Bye bye.
Bye. Nice.
Fare thee well, subtle.
Suck it, nuance.
All right. So make your point, Scott. What are you saying?
My point is that I think he. He, like many of us, is deeply, deeply concerned with the future of the American democracy. And he addressed that. And I don't know that he could have come out and overtly just said, this guy's a nut. And
I know.
But he did address
that. That would not have served any purpose.
I've heard from many people who said they were tearing up in that speech. And when is the last time that has happened? With the presidential farewell address.
Every time Donald Trump speaks,
No. When he was saying goodbye to, and Joe Biden gave that little cock of his finger, and
sweet.
Talking about his wife and his daughter, and
Sasha?
I think this. I can't believe this is true. This has got to be fake news, that she stayed in Washington because she had a test.
She had a test the next day?
Yeah, because,
it was posted on the school website.
And there are colleges that are going to say, come on, Sasha Obama, look at what she got in that science test back when she was sophomore. We're not letting her in.
The school does not forgive missed exams because of travel, and so she had a test the next day, and she had to be there.
To my point, there were people who were, genuinely moved by it, and teared up with it. There was such an emotional attachment to this guy.
It was beautiful in that moment, Steve. I completely agree with you on that. I want to read the editorial from the Chicago Tribune today, same as it ever was. Madigan reelected House Speaker with only one holdout. And I won't read it all, but I just think here's an interesting assessment of the state of Illinois. Thus began Madigan's 17th term as Speaker, arguably the nation's most mismanaged state with an $111 billion unfunded pension liability, more than $10 billion in unpaid bills. Think of that. 2 years without a budget and business and residents fleeing. And the ruling party voiced its confidence in the long-serving speaker and rewarded him with another term. Touche. I don't know if Kristen McQuarrie wrote that, but whoever did, I think that's a nice summary of how absurd it is that Madigan keeps getting put back into the position he's in.
17th term. At the end of this term, he'll be the longest-serving speaker in the history of the country.
Wow.
And
there should be like a 15-term term limit.
Yeah, exactly. It's time we put our foot down.
No, they can't even come to terms on that, Steve. That's unfair. Eric, what's the way out of this? And is Madigan ever going to be capable of something?
Well, it's not getting rid of Madigan. I mean, I know everyone likes to say Madigan's the problem. I think if Lou Lang or someone else had run it, I don't think it would have changed the basic dynamic there. Madigan is the one who is standing between Rauner and his desire to turn Illinois into Indiana or Kansas. I mean, he wants to turn us into one of these red states that is not friendly to unions. And Madigan is that's been Madigan's role. I think what's happened here is that I've perceived a change in tone in Springfield from what I've just in the last couple of days, and it comes from something that Madigan said and wrote in an op-ed, which is that he is now advancing what he needed to be advancing for a long time, which is a Democratic turnaround agenda. He's got some ideas that he wants to implement that he has arguably punted on before, but increasing the minimum wage, cutting the corporate income tax, increasing the edge tax incentives for businesses. What are some of the other things that they're talking about?
Millionaire tax,
which he didn't advance. But if you, he's got some ideas that he wants. Rauner's got some ideas that he wants, and now we're in a position where they can actually do some horse trading. For the last year and a half, Madigan has simply been saying no to Rauner. And I think he's been right to say no to Rauner, but that's not moving the ball at all. I mean, both these guys are very stubborn. It wasn't going to happen. Madigan wasn't really – all Madigan was saying is no, 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 no. Mm-hmm. And again, I think, you know, that's a tactic. But it doesn't move the ball forward. And Rauner wasn't going to give in. Madigan wasn't going to give in. I think we're seeing signs now of a way for them to say, okay, Democrats want this, Rauner wants this, where can we come to the middle? And then we can do this damn budget, which they have just been not touching. So I think it could happen. I think that I'm encouraged, I should say, by what I've heard so far.
Is the pivot point on all of this whether or not these items are attached to the budget or will they be separate items? Is that still a sticking point?
You mean like remap and term limits?
I think it all has to be part of a grand bargain. But again, you can't just say the grand bargain can't be, well, Rauner will agree to negotiate on the budget if Madigan will give him X, Y, and Z. Because you got to negotiate on a budget. I think that what we can say is we're going to have this deal and the budget deal, and they're all going to be one deal. And the Democrats are going to get some of their little turnaround items, and Rauner's going to get some of his. And they're going to meet in the middle somewhere on the budget and spending. And that's how the states, it's got to happen. I'm hoping that it happens, but it has to happen.
I think that's adorable. You still have that
optimism. I know, isn't it sweet? I'm here, and this is like 5 minutes after I accused Obama of being naive.
Now, in your world, do you see Jim Thompson walking into the state house and helping to negotiate this?
Beautiful. Yes, we can.
Turn the clock back.
Good
Lord. All right, let's do our recommendations for the end of the week. These are items that we are watching, reading, listening to, or consuming that we think you might benefit from doing same. Anybody want to start? Is there something that you'd recommend?
I'll go first. And I want to recommend a audio drama called Life After. It's in podcast form, and it's wonderful. I think it's 10 parts, free on the internet, and you can download it. And it's all been uploaded. It's a great, like, quote unquote radio drama, and these things are coming back. And this is really well done. And we listened to it on our recent trip to Pittsburgh, and the family loved it. So,
I'm going to recommend the movie Fences. I don't think I recommended that last week.
Oh, yes.
Not to be confused with Hidden Fences.
Not fair. Don't do it.
This is Fences. And when you tell somebody what the movie is about, I don't think anybody would want to go see it. You know, the coming-of-age story of a kid growing up in a poor black neighborhood coming to terms with his sexual orientation. I'm sure that could be a great movie.
No, wait, you're thinking of Moonlight. You just did it, man. You just did it.
Yeah.
I want to recommend this movie called Moonlight.
Get Jenna Bush on the phone.
Oh, I know. Boy. By the way, I did see Fences too, by the way.
I've seen both of them, and I was thinking, who came to their sexual orientation at Fences? Yeah.
Moonlight is fan-freaking-tastic.
Oh, it is.
I can't see it. This is my rant, is that I hate movie theaters now because they've all redeveloped or revamped. So there are all these cushy recliner seats. So there are half as many seats, so you can't go see these good movies.
Why?
I tried, because the movies theater sell out now. There aren't 100 empty seats in a 400-seat theater.
It's not showing in a lot of theaters now.
No, but I mean, in general, now these theaters that used to hold 250 people are holding 45. It's really hard for me to go see good movies.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm a member of SAG, so I'm screening the movies now.
You're not supposed to share your DVDs with them.
I'm not sharing. I'm saying come over. I haven't watched it yet. So
Scott lives like 2 blocks from here.
A block and a half. So if you want to come and shoot Scott in the back of the head, the address is.
We're devolving here.
I'm a SAG-AFTRA member too, Scott. Isn't that the best thing about being a member?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Movie season at the end of the year, the beginning of the year, they send you all of the current releases that come out for awards consideration.
I'm going to complain about that, too. There's such hypocrisy. I used to be a member of the Chicago Film Critics Association. Yeah. Did you too, John?
Yeah.
And then you would get them because you're voting for the Chicago Film Critics Awards. You guys in after SAG in the far reaches of the country, are getting, and I benefit from them sometimes, but are getting these screeners. And now I think people need to know that it's like you can, guys like you and Stantis, who are voting for the SAG Awards. I don't want you choosing my SAG Award winners.
It does look bad when I can't tell the difference one movie from the other.
And I take it very seriously.
How did you do? What movies were you? I'm Scott Stantis. You may remember me from such movies as
You know, and so the SAG Awards come on, you're like, well, these are the fellow actors choosing. Come on, what is this?
It's
some
Williams.
Cartoonist.
It's the one with the black people. Which one was that? That was a great movie. Yeah, busted.
Fences is really good, too, though.
Fences is good.
I didn't like Fences.
You didn't like Fences?
What?
I would have preferred to see the theater. It was a play. Yeah, it's not a movie.
It was a play, but boy, the acting was great.
Yeah, the acting was
Denzel
great.
Denzel and the woman who plays
Fences
his wife.
Fences is really long.
Viola Davis.
But you know what was great about Fences was they had the Broadway cast was, you know, a lot of the supporting players were from the Broadway cast who were just fantastic actors.
So Viola Davis, they said, how did you remember these lines, these long dialogues? She goes, well, we did it on stage 150 times. You know?
that
so that was part of it.
Yeah. What are you recommending, Steve Bertrand?
I'm going to say Sherlock on PBS. Benedict Cumberbatch before he was cool, and it's back for what I think season 5 or 4 or something, but it's a 4-episode season.
Someone did a thing that says tonight Sherlock the premiere of Sherlock this season, also the season
finale. No, right, but it's on PBS and it's just a great series, and that's my suggestion.
My only problem with Sherlock is the episodes are like 90 minutes long.
Yeah, they are.
It's like a movie.
Brits, they have more time.
They do.
How about you, Scott? What do you like?
Okay,
this week?
I'm reading a book called, and it's about a cartoonist, so you know it's good. But it's actually it's really, really good book called Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. It's about George Harriman, the creator of Crazy Cat. And he was half African American. He was Creole and moved to L.A. and then all of a sudden was not. And it talks about racial politics at the turn of the 20th century. It talks about a creative genius in George Harriman and his career. It is absolutely, I mean, worth your time, effort, and treasure, because it's beautifully written. Michael Tizerand is the author, and he does a magnificent job.
Hmm. Well, you're an editorial cartoonist, but you're a strip cartoonist too, right?
Yeah,
Scott?
I do Prickly City, which is in about 130 papers around the country.
And how hard is that? How much pressure are those two assignments each day or each week?
Oh, drawing
week?
A cartoon every day, 300 plus days a year. Nothing.
65 is
different. For a moment, I was going 356, but I go, that can't be right.
So this is true. This is your creative release to come up and spend time with us, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. Pick it up. It's a really good read.
That's Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune. Read Eric Zorn in the Chicago Tribune as well. And listen to our very own Steve Bertrand on WGN Radio. I'm John Williams. Again, portions of this podcast are broadcast Saturdays at 1:30 on WGN Radio. Thank you very much to our engineer. That's Ben Cortez. And the producer of The Mincing Rascals is Kristen Decker. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus podcast network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 1:30 to 2 p.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.
You listen.